This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Luis Ahoyas, the director and producer of the Academy Award-winning documentary film The Cove. We discuss reactions to the film, including the recent censorship issue in Japan, and how the movie is raising awareness about the capture and slaughter of dolphins and dangerously high mercury levels in our oceans.
This is not an animal rights film to me. I mean, that's not how we're going to win this argument. I don't think it's going to be on a human rights argument. They're feeding these toxic animals to school children.
Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Luis Ahoyas, the director and producer of The Cove. He was also a photojournalist for 35 years for publications such as National Geographic. Luis, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Nice to be here.
My reaction to the film with my wife, we watched it, was we expected just the dolphin horror to confront us. That was kind of what we had heard about the film, was this was this terrible slaughter of these dolphins. But then a second horror kind of raises its head in the film, which is mercury issue. And so this is really a film with two activist environmental messages, isn't it?
Yeah. To me, the Cove is a microcosm of a lot of different issues that are, you know, that the oceans are facing. And, you know, through telling the story of this, you know, I got to back up. I mean, it's, you know, to me, it's not a horror movie. I mean, it is. I hate horror movies. I didn't want to make a horror movie. Really, this is the Disney version. When you see there's one sequence at the end of the movie, you know it's coming. You can close your eyes if you want to, but it's really, I hope it feels empowering to people when they see it, that it's not just about dolphins getting killed. It's really, at the end of the day, the movie's really about what we're doing to ourselves. You know, because we're destroying the oceans. It's not just the dolphins and whales that are becoming toxic because of what we're dumping into the environment. You know, those toxins bioaccumulate up the food chain, and it's things that Western civilizations like to eat, like, you know, marlin, shark, swordfish, tuna, all the stuff that we're raised on as kids as being healthy is now really kind of toxic. Very toxic, actually, if you eat a lot of it. So there's a lot of messages to the film, at the end of the day, hopefully the real takeaway of the movie is that one person can make a difference, because that's what you see. You know, the hero of our movie, Rickleberry, the guy, the train flipper, goes in to help, you know, basically inspires us to help save these animals. So,
but let's take a step even farther back and go back to your journalism days, before you made The Cove, and tell us about some of the projects that informed you and how you became passionate about issues like the dolphin incidents that occur frequently in Taiji, Japan.
I come from a generation of photojournalists that would be called concerned photographers. You know, we're not just into, you know, shooting pretty pictures. We're trying to convey social messages and, you know, inspire change through photojournalism. The Cove is my first movie. And, you know, the genesis of that idea was that, you know, I was a photographer for Fortune magazine. After working with National Geographic, I photographed people that make too much money for about 5 years. You know, people like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, you know, Larry Ellison.
Is that how you met Jim Clark?
That's how I met Jim Clark. Yeah, Jim Clark is a serial entrepreneur. He started three businesses from scratch. You know, Netscape being probably the most obvious of them, but Silicon Graphics, the first 3D graphics engine. We've been, you know, diving together for a long time, and, you know, every time we go back to the same dive spot, we see the degradation of the oceans before our very eyes. There's less fish every time we go back, less coral through, you know, bleaching or, you know, all sorts of pressures on the oceans right now. And the third time we were in the Galapagos, we saw illegal longline fishermen in a marine sanctuary. And Jim said, somebody should do something about this. And I said, well, how about you and I? And we hatched this idea to start the Oceanic Preservation Society. I'm the executive director, and we make films to basically inspire change, you know, to create awareness, and most importantly, to inspire people to help change them.
And Jim Clark was one of the financiers of the movie. A lot of people, and for our listeners who haven't seen the film, there's a definitely an element of an action picture and almost a military commando way that you go about trying to capture the events in Taiji.
The movie, first of all, it's set up like it's a thriller. You know, the first line of the movie is me saying, I just want to say we try to do the story legally. So, you know, you're going to witness a crime. And what we do is we break into a Japanese national park that's forbidden for even Japanese people to go into. It's protected. It's a, you know, the cove refers to this national park that's like a natural fortress protected on three sides by steep cliffs. They have guard dogs there, sensors, you know, surveillance cameras, 24-hour guards. In our case, we had 24/7 police, you know, following us around wherever we went. As soon as we left the hotel, we were being followed. And this is all documented well in the film. But it's based on basically an Ocean's 11 movie. It's like a heist movie. And in fact, at the Oscars, I met George Clooney. He said, this is better than an Ocean's 11 movie because it's real. It's a, you know, so first of all, that's what you're going to see. It's a thriller. I think that's why it's been winning all the awards, because it doesn't feel like a documentary. You know, most documentaries are, you know, like, you know, we're the Brussels sprouts of cinema. You know, it's like, you know, most people don't love documentaries. They see them only as a last ditch effort. And this film feels like, you know, an Ocean's 11 movie. It's you know, first of all, it's entertainment, but it's entertainment with a mission. You get the exposition is delivered, and you're getting, you know, you're getting sort of fed this documentary, you know, as you're, you know, as we're breaking into the cove, you start, the stakes get raised. It's not just about filming this horror act. It's about these other issues. So eventually it touches everybody. It's not just about, you know, us versus them. It's what we're doing to ourselves.
And originally you were not planning on being in the movie at all, right? But what was the what helped you make that leap from being a journalist to or being, let's say, a spectator to an active participant or activist?
So, you know, I've been documenting events forever, and it feels like you're always a spectator. And it felt like I, you know, I shed a new skin when I felt like, you know what, I can actually do something to try to prevent this from happening. And there was like a watershed moment in my own career where I felt like, God, I can use everything I've been doing, but use it for good instead of just trying to document stuff. Because, you know, we're running out of time to just be observers.
Louis, can you tell us a little bit about how the film covers the commercial trade of live dolphins?
But you go to a SeaWorld or a Marineland or whatever, and you think, okay, what's wrong with this? The dolphins are smiling, you know, people are laughing, they're having a great time, but you never get to see, you know, to feel the experience from, you know, the performer, in this case, the dolphin's perspective. And you get to, you know, these dolphins, you know, dolphins have larger brains than our own. So they have more convolutions of the gray matters for sensory neurons. They're more sensitive than us. They have more spindle neurons, which are related to complex emotions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, more complex family structures. On just about every level, they're more sophisticated than us. So, you know, when you get to understand that these animals, you really don't belong in captivity, then you start to have sympathy and pathos for this other species. And, you know, that's part of the genesis of, you know, this movie, is that it helps transform people into understanding that, you know, we're not the only species on the planet. There's 10 million other species out there. We are but one. And just because we subjugated them doesn't mean, you know, I think when you take a wild sentient animal, you know, out of nature, and you force them to do stupid tricks for our amusement, it says more about our intelligence than it does theirs.
Speaking of their brains, one of the questions I had watching the movie was obviously the criminally high levels of mercury in our oceans that are then going to our larger fish and mammals like dolphins. But I was wondering, has there been any studies done, or are you aware of the impact of these high mercury levels on the dolphins' brains?
It does the same thing. You know, I've seen the, well, first of all, I've seen the what happens to a human brain on mercury. You know, there's a big accident in Japan about, mid-1950s called, you know, Minamata. It's called Minamata's disease, but it's not a disease. It's really a poison or a toxicity from these insanely high levels of mercury that, in this case, got dumped in the environment. It basically makes Swiss cheese out of your brain. And it does the same thing to dolphin brains. But, you know, it's not very well studied in human beings, much less dolphins. I found out I had mercury poisoning when I was making the movie. I went to interview these doctors. In this case, it was Dr. Kino from near Minamata at this university. And I took him and his researchers out to lunch after interviewing him in the morning. And I said, they said to me, what do you like to eat? And I said, sushi, I love sushi. And so they took me to a sushi restaurant near the hospital. And my Japanese interpreter ordered these big platters of Japanese sushi, very expensive. And I looked down at the Japanese researchers halfway through the meal, and none of them were eating the sushi. They were eating the vegetables and the miso. None of them was eating the sushi, not one piece. And I said, what's with this? You know, Japanese people eat more fish than anybody on the planet. You know, 66 kilos per person per year. They're eating their weight in seafood. And Dr. Kino said to me, he said, you should know that the six of us around this table were curious how fast mercury bioaccumulates in the human body. They did this experiment. They called it the supersize me experiment, but Japanese style. They each ate 200 grams of tuna every day for a month. 200 grams of tuna is like less than half a can of tuna fish, about 7 ounces, what I would put on a couple crackers. And they would measure their mercury at the end of each week. At the end of 2 weeks, their levels had doubled. One of the doctors dropped out because he could see where this test was going. Those kept on. But they were eating tuna that was from bonito, a very small, short-lived tuna. They thought there must be something wrong with the bonito. So they sprung for more, you know, they just pitched in a little bit more money and they got the good stuff, the sushi-grade tuna, you know, from bluefin and yellowfin. At the end of the 4 weeks, their levels went up an average of 8 times. They're now into the levels of the victims that they're researching. And he said, Dr. Aquino said to me, you should know that none of us at the hospital eats fish anymore.
It was pretty obvious that you didn't expect this part of the story to be as big as it was, as you uncovered not only the mercury levels in dolphins, but feeding it to the school children. And you obviously expected some abuses or you wouldn't have gone to Taiji, Japan. But that was an unexpected turn, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the mercury is there because of us. I mean, it's the way that these lights are on is, you know, most likely through natural gas or coal. Coal is particularly nasty because there's a lot of mercury in it. And that gets put into the rivers, lakes, streams, ponds. Because it's not just it's not ocean fish. There's now mercury advisories for every state in America because of the burning of fossil fuels is polluting the oceans to these massive levels. The whole last half of this movie was done with solar energy. I mean, if I can do it, certainly governments can do it. You know, certainly, you know, other individuals can do it. We start to look at the real cost of our energy. That's the other, you know, talking about what's this movie about? It's, you know, at the end of the day, hopefully it's about energy and changing the way we get our energy. And that's, you know, we all can do it. You know, it's we did it. It's simple. The other component of this is that fossil fuels, and it's not just dumping a lot of mercury in the environment, it's making the oceans more acidic. By the end of this century, there will be no more coral reefs if we keep on continuing the way we are, because carbon gets absorbed by the oceans, makes the oceans more acidic, and it's dissolving the coral reefs. So, you know, your great-grandchildren won't be able to go to their vacations or out there, you know, if you live on the long coast, and ever see a coral reef because of our cheap energy. You got to factor that into the cost of your cheap, you know, gasoline and coal right now. If you're going to look at, you know, if you're a businessman, you look at the total cost of doing business. You can't just look at production and shipping. You have to look at what's the environmental cost too, if you're really concerned with future generations.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Our guest is the director of The Cove, Louis Sohoyas. Louis, as somebody who's spent a lot of time in Japan and speaks the language, I was particularly interested in that part of the film. Can you tell us about the recent censorship issue you've encountered with theatrical distribution of the film there?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, people said, you know, it's great to have a movie that's won all those awards, but it'll never get into Japan where it's, you know, needs to be most seen. And, you know, we're coming out, this is, you know, we're at the end of June right now. We're coming out on July 3rd, I think it's like 23 theaters there. There's a very strong right-wing activism program in Japan. It's basically Yakuza-like organizations that, under the guise of free speech, have been censoring this movie fairly effectively. They got two of the biggest theaters in Tokyo and one in Osaka to not show the film. They threatened them. They would show up in front of the theater, in front of the distributor's house with these shout trucks, these big trucks with big megaphones on the side. And then basically they're calling the distributor's wife a whore, telling where the kids go to school, threatening them. I've got death threats this morning.
Well, try living there on a Sunday morning when those trucks are terrorizing neighborhoods on a consistent basis with their, you know, they go through a neighborhood and they blare nationalist music at a real ear piercing level. They're the Uyoku Daitan. They're a pseudo terrorist organization in a lot of ways, the way they use intimidation, and you've been witnessing this firsthand, it sounds like.
Yeah, and they shut down a couple theaters, and this became national news in Japan and international news. And what this did, though, is it triggered a free speech debate in Japan that the likes of haven't been seen before. So, you know, one of the courts in Yokohama just ruled yesterday that the protesters can't show up at the theaters and prevent people from seeing it. And so it sparked this free speech debate. And so now the movie is much bigger than just the movie now. It's, you know, I couldn't have orchestrated a better media campaign myself if I had planned it.
So more people are going to see the movie as a result of this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this movie was never out there to make money. You know, we're a nonprofit organization.
But people to see it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'd be happy to give this movie away for free we couldn't have promoted it better than these right-wing activists have been doing. And so it's backfired on them.
And one of the things that one of the reasons they gave was that it was anti-Japanese and that it had connections with the anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd. And you have, I guess, Paul Watson is interviewed in The Cove as well.
Yeah, that's what they call me, is an eco-terrorist. And yeah, the movie does have, you know, Paul Watson is one character in the movie, but we also have Joji Morishita, the head of the IWC. He's in there. We have Morinuki, who's the deputy minister of fisheries. He's in there. I mean, just because, and they have their opinions are expressed. We're pretty fair that way. It doesn't seem like it. You know, one of the problems with documentaries is that when you have a side, let's say, you know, if you're talking about child pornography or human slavery.
It's hard to show both sides equally.
Well,
right?
Well, you do with the other side. The other side, they sound like idiots because it's indefensible. How can you talk about plundering the seas or, you know, baby raping or, you know, any of these subjects and give fair, you know, equal, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And when we do, it makes it sound like we're not giving them a voice. We are. It's just that when they come on online, they sound ridiculous. They were saying far more ridiculous things than in the movie, but it just sounded like insane.
You were very fair, I believe, in portraying the fact that most Japanese don't know about this practice and are ashamed of it when they see it. So it's not like all Japanese are in there trying to enjoy the meat of dolphins.
Yeah, and, you know, well, I think the reason that the mayor's office in Taiji didn't want us to film this is because they realized that if the Japanese people themselves saw it, it would be indefensible. I mean, how can, you know, this is not an animal rights film to me. I mean, that's not how we're going to win this argument. I don't think it's going to be on a human rights argument. They're feeding these toxic animals to school children. And so it's human rights. Every human is entitled to safe food. This to me was fascinating. In 2007, this movie, it takes a long time to make a movie and to edit it. And I didn't want to have this information out and not have it available to the Japanese people. So we made a PSA, a public service announcement, that was taken down to the IWC when we were in Santiago, Chile at the International Whaling Convention meeting. And I thought, I got to get this information out. So I had these basically small versions of The Cove made, to take down to the IWC delegation, the Japanese. And I thought, they know I'm making this film now about dolphin hunting. It'd be really hard to get them to see it. I get on the plane from Dallas down to Santiago, 10-hour flight, completely full flight except for one seat right next to me. Right before the plane door closes, in comes Akira Nakamai. He's the head, the deputy minister of the overseas fisheries, the guy. He's the guy in charge of all whale, dolphin, and porpoise killing in Japan, and all fishing. And he sits down right next to me. And I thought, if there is a God, he has a really great sense of humor. I waited till the plane took off so he couldn't change seats with anybody else. And I said to him, you know, after we took off and the meal's starting to get served, I said, do you have any idea who I am? He goes, no. And I said, well, I know who you are. After dinner, I want to show you a movie. And I said to him, he was like smoking, he was shaking, he was red, you know, because he realized that, you know, we show how we got into the cove, we show the mercury levels. And I said, listen, you're the guy, he spoke really well, you know, really good English. And I said, you're the guy that's in charge of 5,000 tons of toxic dolphin meat being distributed to school children every year. How do you reconcile that? And he said, oh, I'm the head of food security, not the head of food safety. You know, in other words, he's just concerned with enough protein being on the table. He's not concerned about what's actually in the protein. But we had a long conversation, you know, which, you know, I wish we could have recorded it. You know, I asked him to do it once when we landed, before we landed, and he agreed to it. And then he, you know, he declined after.
But he is in the film, right?
This guy, he's in the film. He's not talking in the film. It's really Joji Morishita, his underling, that's talking. But he said, you know, we realized that, by the way, about 2 weeks before I went on that trip, the Australian government just caught the Japanese government overfishing bluefin tuna. They looked at the reports and found that they're overfishing bluefin tuna in the Pacific at the rate of about 50% a year for the last like 17 years. And, you know, they were trying to, the Japanese government was trying to get them to, you know, to hush this up, and they wouldn't, the Australian wouldn't let them do it. And so he here's the guy now that's been caught overfishing bluefin. And they were fine, but you know, how do you pay back a species that's being, you know, heading towards extinction? And he said, yeah, I know. He said, I know we're overfishing. I know we're plundering the oceans. But what am I going to do? I'm in charge of food security. You know, we're an island nation. You look at us. We're, you know, we're surrounded by water. Where are we going to go for food? 70% of our land is only flat enough to either grow food or live on. So we have to look to the sea for protein. But, you know, he said, well, we're about the size of your California. We have about 100, I think he said 400, but in their case, 145 million people packed into a space the size of California. He said, the real danger you should be looking at is China, because they're getting more fish than us now. So they're basically out there, along with Americans too, trying to get the last fish. You know, we're all, you know, we're subsidizing the fishing industry. We're out there plundering. And we, it's just like whaling, you know, that you look at whaling and, you know, the scientists back, you know, in the 30s were saying, this isn't sustainable. Up until we couldn't, you know, these animals were nearly commercial. They were commercially extinct. That's when we decided, hey, you know, maybe there should be a moratorium. And just last week, just voted to uphold the moratorium. But, you know, that was 3 days ago. That was very much in flux. That the, you know, the greatest ecological achievement of the last century was in debate last week. I mean, we haven't come so far that we're talking about opening up the seas to whaling again. I mean, we almost stepped backwards a couple decades last week. So
why don't you tell us a little bit more about what happened last week?
Well, the IWC was meeting in Morocco last week, and the U.S. was actually backing a program in which we would erase the moratorium, you know, that which started in 1986. All the whaling nations, all the whaling and anti-whaling nations got together in 1982 and decided, okay, it's not sustainable. They implemented it in 1986. So there hasn't been commercial whaling since 1986, except in Norway and Iceland, who protested, you know, the way the IWC works out. If you protest the, you know, any law is not binding to that country. Japan didn't protest it, but they do what's called scientific whaling under, you know, the guise of this, of scientific whaling, you know, to hunt whales for science. They exploit this loophole to basically do commercial whaling. And, you know, the world, of course, has been outraged for, you know, the last 25 years. And in last week, the U.S. government was trying to put some controls on their scientific whaling, but that would open it. That would have opened it up the laws again, the oceans for commercial whaling, and that was voted down. I'm not sure what it was, but you know they need a 3/4 majority to withhold any kind of new amendment, and that would be very difficult to do again. But the idea that it was being backed by the American government, by the Obama administration, was horrifying to every NGO in the world. And luckily, they didn't win the vote.
And have you seen any result from the critical acclaim that your movie has received in terms of trying to help close these loopholes in the International Whaling Commission?
Yeah, we showed the movie last year when it was in Portugal, and a lot of the delegates saw the movie. And you know, we have a sequence in there where we show how the Japanese have been buying the boats of landlocked countries like Mali, Mongolia, where I used to live in the West Indies, Antigua. You know, our own government there had been, you know, we know they'd been bought out, but we actually exposed that. And, well, you know, one of the delegate from Monaco, he gave this film the best compliment it's ever received. And here's a guy that's been working. He's a doctor, like a real doctor. And he's one of the delegate from Monaco. And he said, you know, the Cove is worth 1,000 speeches. You know, pictures worth 1,000 words. The Cove, you know, so the Cove is, you know, it's permeated levels of government. You know, I testified before Congress last month about the captive dolphin industry, where, you know, this movie has somehow hit a chord. So we have like a grassroots sort of movement to inspire people to change. And it was also working from a government level on down, you know, bottom up, top down. It's, you know, it's far exceeded my expectations for what it could achieve for a movie. And it's, you know, it's still out there doing its work.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is Louis Sahoyas, the director and producer of the documentary film The Cove. Louis, you testified before the Congressional Subcommittee on Ocean Affairs about the dolphin trade.
Because of The Cove and because of two SeaWorld dolphins that killed two trainers within 2 months, they were re-looking into the laws that allow marine mammals to be in captivity. There has to be an educational component to it, or a conservation component. There has to be that sort of a reason for us to exploit these animals. And, you know, I look at the captive dolphin industry and I think, you know, it's, you're watching, when you see a dolphin show, you know, these aren't ambassadors of the sea. You're watching a human display of dominance. And I think everybody on that committee, all the congressmen and congresswomen, were at the beginning pro dolphinariums, but after our testimony, you know, Naomi Rose from the Humane Society, myself, and a few, and Lori Marino, you know, scientists have been working on this captive dolphin issue for, you know, for generations. They said they've never seen so much progress in the last 16 years since the Marine Mammal Protection Act as what we've achieved with the Cove. And so I feel like, you know, this movie is making a difference somehow. You know, when every day when I went from my house to the studio in the backyard when we were making this movie, I felt I could be really delusional. You know, who am I to think I can make a movie? And, you know, I always, you know, I told the crew, we're not making a movie. We're trying to start a movement. And that's the difference. You know, this isn't a popcorn movie. This isn't, you know, you'll get entertained. I guarantee you, you see this movie, you'll love it. You're going to learn too.
How long has the practice been going on in Japan?
Well, dolphin hunting has been going on for 400 years, but, you know, they've only been doing it with the fast dry boat since 1933. When the dolphin hunters say this is our tradition, it's like, well, 1933 hardly qualifies as a tradition. My mother is older than their tradition. Even like whale hunting was not this great, glorious tradition in Japan. There's a book that was recently written about Japanese whaling by a Japanese ecologist who said, it's never been our tradition. It's always been a tradition of these few coastal towns that, you know, that would catch whales, but it would never permeated the whole culture. It was only post-World War II when there was a protein shortage and General MacArthur allowed them to convert ships to go over to go back into the Antarctic to get protein. You know, some traditions are good. Some of them, you know, we had a tradition in America of slavery, much longer than whaling. We have a tradition of not allowing women to vote. You know, we had a tradition in where I come from in Colorado of making triggers for plutonium bombs down in Rocky Flats. The workers there told us the same thing the fishermen are telling us, the dolphin hunters are telling us in Japan. What are you going to do if we lose our tradition? Well, in Rocky Flats, the guys are making plutonium triggers. They found something else to do.
Louis Sahoyas, thank you so much for being with us and doing the work that you're doing.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Additional music by Tiger Akoshi, Johnny Jenkins, and Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.